Chapter 15. The Rubicon Con. In the winter of 1985, South Africa was in flames. Black South Africans weren't buying feeble attempts by the National Party to reform apartheid and embarked on rolling mass action. There were strikes, boycotts, and stayaways. The ANC called on communities to make townships ungovernable. An uprising that had erupted in Johannesburg townships in September 1984 spread countrywide. Prime Minister P.W. Botha, the finger-wagging, teeth-baring strongman, responded with an iron fist. In an effort to crush the resistance, he declared a state of emergency in key districts on 20th July 1985. Activists were banned, arrested, tortured, and assassinated. Some simply disappeared without a trace. The army patrolled the townships, bulldozed squatter camps, and used live ammunition against protesters. Hundreds of people were killed. Funerals became rallying points for anti-government gatherings where the colors of the banned ANC were on display. The problem was not only political. The country was also on the brink of bankruptcy. It was in this context of spiraling violence and political and economic crises that the NP's Natal Congress was to take place on 15th August in Durban. In the run-up to the Congress, word spread that Botha was going to announce the death of Grand Apartheid. Some whites were counting out 30 pieces of silver to give to Botha, and others were fearful Swart Gevaar propaganda may have worked too well. But many people, black and white, were hopeful that these reforms would prevent the conflict erupting into full-scale civil war. At the Congress that Thursday, Botha stood up and declared, "I believe that we are today crossing the Rubicon. There can be no turning back." It was a bald-faced lie. As it turned out, Botha didn't cross the Rubicon, a reference to Julius Caesar's march across Italy's shallow Rubicon River that spawned the Roman Empire and the genesis of modern European culture. Botha's speech was, as historian Herman Guillaume pointed out, the turning point at which white rule in South Africa failed to turn. Botha, known as die Groot Krokodil, was abrasive and had a temper often described as legendary. His cabinet ministers were terrified of him, and on occasion he reduced them to tears. He had been elected to parliament in 1948 when the NP came to power under D.F. Malan, and he rose up the political ranks. Minister of Community Development and Coloured Affairs in 1961, Minister of Defence in 1966, Prime Minister in 1978. As Guillaume noted, Botha's power was direct and personal. He was a straight talker, tough, brutal, overpowering, and at times thuggish, vindictive, and petty. But he was also a pragmatist, and soon after coming to power, he realised South Africa had reached a political deadlock. In 1979, he proposed scrapping petty laws that prohibited blacks from sitting on the same benches as whites and eating in white restaurants. He even considered repealing the Prohibition of Mixed Marriages Act and the Immorality Act that outlawed interracial marriages and sex across the colour line, see Chapter 3. He challenged far-right-wing Afrikaners to adapt or die. Bishop Desmond Tutu, then the General Secretary of the South African Council of Churches, was sceptical. "All this amounts to his shifting furniture around but leaving the room just the same," he scoffed. Progressive Federal Party leader Frederick van Zyl Slabbert shared similar sentiments, describing Botha's reforms as the political equivalent of rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. Tutu and Slabbert were right. Botha steadfastly refused to grant black people political power. In 1983, his program of reforming apartheid saw him introduce the tricameral parliament, in which whites, coloureds, and Indians were represented in racially separate chambers. Black South Africans were left out in the cold, not that there was much warmth in the Indian and coloured chambers. The tricameral parliament gave the pretense of power sharing, but it banished black South Africans to 10 tribal homelands far from economic opportunities and kept political power in the hands of the white minority. Apartheid was adapting and still very much alive. In the meantime, Chris Hiernes, the Minister of Constitutional Development, was chairing a cabinet committee looking into a constitutional framework to accommodate the political aspirations of black South Africans. The committee concluded that a Bantustan-style solution was impractical, and the state needed to negotiate with credible black leaders to bring them into the national government. However, Hyenas couldn't negotiate with credible black leaders because they were either in jail or in exile. He wrote to Buerta expressing his frustration at the committee's slow progress. Buerta responded by calling an extended cabinet meeting on 2 August 1985 at the Oosterwach, a military intelligence building in Pretoria. The agenda was constitutional reform, and the intention was that Buerta would announce decisions taken there at the Nats Natal Congress a fortnight later. According to Jan Hyenas, Chris Hyenas' son and the author of The Inner Circle: Reflections on the Last Days of White Rule, the main decision was to accommodate black people in the cabinet. It was an important step because it recognized that black South Africans were citizens and entitled to participate in decision-making. Buerta was quiet and didn't object to the major reforms proposed. When Hyenas left the Oosterwach meeting, he had no reason to doubt that the Prime Minister was ready to cross the Rubicon. Neither did Minister of Foreign Affairs Pik Buerta, who joined Minister of Finance Barend du Plessis in making suggestions for PW's speech. Hyenas prepared a draft pledging the government to recognize black human dignity, eradicate all forms of discrimination, and create equal opportunities. Pik went overseas on a special mission to meet British, American, and German leaders and market the changes, which he boasted included recommendations for the political involvement of blacks at the highest level, citizenship for all South Africans, a single territory for the whole country, and possibly even the release of Nelson Mandela. News of a possible breakthrough started to filter through, and there was a feeling that the embattled apartheid government had found a way out of the political deadlock. Time magazine described it as the most important announcement since the Dutch settlers arrived in South Africa 300 years ago. More than 200 million people around the world, including President Ronald Reagan in the White House, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher in No. 10 Downing Street, and ANC President Oliver Tambo in Zambia, tuned into the broadcast expecting to hear PW announcing bold changes that would end apartheid. Instead, a defiant Buerta wagged his finger at the cameras and said he would not surrender to pressure. He reprimanded the media, railed against the idea of one man, one vote, and raged against the destructive actions of barbaric communist agitators. "Don't push us too far," the defiant crocodile growled, before ending his speech with the infamous words, "I believe that we are today crossing the Rubicon. There can be no turning back." It was vintage Buerta, says David Welsh, author of The Rise and Fall of Apartheid. Giliomi says PW projected himself as the uncompromising leader of a white minority determined to fight to the end for its survival. But amid expectations of great change, the speech came as a major blow. Everyone was stunned. Well, nearly everyone. Hyenas wasn't surprised at all. A few days earlier, Buerta had torn up his draft and told him he refused to make that prog speech, a reference to Fancel Slabbert's Liberal Opposition Party in Parliament. It didn't take long for the world to recover, and the reaction was severe. Chase Manhattan said it would stop rolling over loans to South African lenders. Other banks followed. Capital fled the country, sanctions were imposed, and the bottom fell out of the rand. Gerard de Kock, the governor of the Reserve Bank, remarked that the Rubicon speech cost the country a few million rand per word. Many years later, Pik Buerta, who is said to have come up with the crossing the Rubicon line, was asked why PW changed his mind about announcing far-reaching changes. "It remains a mystery to me," he replied. "If you find out, come and tell me too." Almost four decades after the ill-fated speech, the mystery endures. One theory, according to Jan Hyenas, is that Buerta was furious that the media had stolen his thunder by publishing speculative reports a week before the Congress. Another is that he changed his mind when news reached him that Pik had overpromised when he briefed diplomats about the changes. And then, of course, Buerta may never have intended to cross the Rubicon at all. What we do know is that the speech was an unmitigated political and economic disaster for South Africa. In the end, Buerta didn't follow his own advice. He couldn't adapt and he died, first politically when he resigned the NAT leadership in 1989 and was forced out of power 6 months later, then of a heart attack at his home in Wilderness in 2006. History will note that he was too obstinate, too pig-headed, too belligerent, too angry, and too full of hate to cross the Rubicon. To put it another way, P.W. Botha was just too P.W. Botha. He may not have crossed the Rubicon on 15th August 1985, but in a way South Africa did. The Rubicon speech changed the political climate. It made the liberation movement even more determined to overthrow the government, which hastened the end of apartheid.